Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Cloudy skies. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, Atlanta's Transportation Commissioner Josh Rowan joins me to discuss the plan for bringing e-scooters back to Atlanta.
We learned some lessons the hard way last time around when the market got flooded with the scooters, and really looking at who can partner with the city. One of the things we're really concerned about now is, you know, areas where essential workers may be struggling with transit reduction, and really how does it fit as a transportation solution, not necessarily just something for joyriding, if you will.
That conversation coming up in just a moment. But first, an update on the Ahmaud Arbery case. A preliminary hearing date of June 4th has been set for the three men accused of murder in the fatal shooting of Arbery. Gregory McMichael, Travis McMichael, and William Bryan Jr. are currently in custody. Lawyers for the McMichaels say the public has unfairly rushed to judge their clients. The attorney for Bryan says he was just a bystander. Meanwhile, the legal team for the Arbery family has maintained the killing was racially motivated, and therefore they want federal hate crime charges added. In other news, here's the latest information as it relates to the coronavirus here in Georgia. As of 9 a.m. today, there are 44,932 confirmed COVID-19 cases. The number of deaths statewide is reported to be 1,957. And there are 7,746 hospitalized. All this information is according to the Georgia Department of Public Health, again, as of 9 a.m. today. And in related news, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp is scheduled to give an update on the state's COVID-19 response efforts later today. Now, based on remarks the governor made while visiting Macon yesterday, the expectation is the governor will lift more restrictions.
We can't keep fighting the virus from our living room. You know, the hospitals have been fighting it every day right here. Our first responders are fighting it on the streets out there every day. And the general public's got to learn to do that as well. And I believe that they have.
And that is from the Macon News outlet, WMAZ. Kemp's press conference is scheduled for 4 p.m. And finally, Atlanta-based rappers and business owners Killer Mike and T.I. are partnering with the WellStar Health System to provide free meals to frontline workers. Now, healthcare workers can pick up meals from the Bankhead Seafood Truck today until 2 p.m. So at the time of this broadcast, you got about an hour. The truck is parked at WellStar Atlanta Medical Center South. This is Closer Look. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. During this time, you may have noticed more folks are biking, running, walking, and even skateboarding. But not so much with another mode of microtransportation. Now, earlier this year, the Atlanta City Council passed legislation with revised regulations regarding, hold on, shareable dockless mobility devices, or as we plain folk call them, e-scooters. Now, the updated regulations include mandates for e-scooter operators and how the permitting process will now work if companies want to operate their scooters in Atlanta. Well, I'm joined now by Josh Rowan. He's the city's inaugural commissioner of the Atlanta Department of Transportation. Commissioner Rowan, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thank you for having me.
I want to begin here because at the time of this conversation, Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms has just announced the city will enter phase two of reopening. Now, does that include that the e-scooter operators can drop some scooters here, or we'll need to get into that later? Because as of right now, I don't really see many.
No, if I may back up a little bit, one of the things that we did was when the stay-at-home orders were first placed, the the scooters were deemed non-essential, and we asked them to pick up their devices. So that's why you haven't seen them. Mm-hmm. In the background, we had city council approve a process to implement a new permit for the scooters. We have conducted that permit process and have made our final recommendations to the mayor for her approval.
Yeah, we'll get into that in just a second. So to be clear for our listeners, with this permitting process, there will be a maximum number of e-scooter companies allowed to operate in Atlanta?
Correct. I think we had 9 operating before. We will select. Generally speaking, it'll be 2 to 3 scooter operators. Plus, we also want to look at the diversity of the fleet. So introducing e-bikes, even the sit-down scooters. And so it'll be fewer operators with fewer total number of devices.
Will that weigh heavily in favor of one company if they're able to offer e-bikes and scooters, maybe?
No, it's really, really looking at, you know, who's going to provide the best service. We learned some lessons the hard way, I think, mm-hmm. the last time around when the market got flooded with the scooters, and really looking at who can partner with the city. One of the things we're really concerned about now is, you know, areas that where essential workers may be struggling with transit reduction, and really how does it fit as a transportation solution, not necessarily just something for joyriding, if you will.
So that's the focus for why you all would want to give a contract to an e-scooter company, that it is part of being a viable mode of transportation for folks to get to and from work or to and from school, not just for folks to enjoy on the Beltline. But one might argue, well, listen, they're for entertainment too. What's your response to that?
Yeah, we're hearing a lot of stories, emails from folks saying that, you know, they have a 4-mile walk to their nearest train station, and it's just a little too far, and that there's been an uptick in having to commit funds to rideshare to get to work. And so we're concerned about, you know, how can we use our public spaces, specifically the streets, to support economic recovery. And the scooters are going to have a place in there. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, it's going to be as a transportation solution, really around transit. Maybe replacing in areas where there's been service drop-off, connectivity to the rail stations, and working with the various operators to really support the needs of the workforce as they get in and out of the city.
So regions will play a part in this. In some areas where you just mentioned there may be a reduction in MARTA bus service, or if there is a long commute to the nearest MARTA station. So you're going to be looking at perhaps specific neighborhoods that might require more of these scooters and ask your operators to make sure they have a sufficient amount of scooters available for certain regions? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. And it dovetails with part of the announcement this morning, the administrative order regarding using streets for economic recovery. We know that the sidewalks are not where we want the scooters, and in many cases the streets aren't quite ready for the devices. And so we're looking at what we can do to provide that space, and it's really looking closely at the connectivity to the MARTA stations and what that means for the workers, you know, who mm-hmm. really looking at a model where people who are living west and southwest of the city needing to get into Midtown or Buckhead, how we can support that transportation without a car.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Rowan, you just mentioned lessons learned from this first venture with these e-scooters where, you know, some companies just came into Atlanta, dropped scooters off. You all didn't even know about it. I think at one point, as you mentioned, we might have had 9 scooter companies operating here in Atlanta. What are the top 2 lessons you think came out of that for the city?
The 2 biggest changes in my mind that we made in this permit process, one is just how we're permitting them. We won't have 9 operators. Mm-hmm. It'll be less than that. The other thing is we're going to implement a system where we have a primary permit for an initial 500 devices, and then we will have sub-permits in increments of 500. So that gives us the ability to control the size of the fleet. So mm-hmm. if we see an operator who's not operating in a manner that we think is beneficial to the city, we have more control over the fleet size and as well as their permit to work with them to provide a service and not have necessarily what I think we all used to joke, the scooter clutter, where we were just oversaturating mm-hmm. areas of the city, you know, fighting for ride share. So that's going to be a big change, is just in that how we permit the devices. The other one Number two is the fewer operators. So we're going to be able to work more closely together. And knowing this is an iterative process, I think they've also learned over the last 18 months better how to read the demand and where to deploy their devices.
And the process for companies to apply, it will be through the city's Department of Transportation, through your department.
That's correct. In fact, we have already implemented that process and are finalizing our selection and working with the mayor's team to get approval, essentially to cooperate with this phase two easing, a slow rollout of the scooter devices.
Now, there were some issues, obviously, last time, too, with you all having to pick up scooters and you're having to, for lack of a better word, almost house them. And I think there are fines levied to some of these scooter companies. Has all that been worked out? Has everybody paid you, basically, that owes you?
So mostly, yes. That was the end of the year. We had quite a bit of attention given to the scooters that were picked up and housed down at our Claire Drive facility. We worked out a model where we looked at the cost for what the city had expended and doing that work to police the right of way, and worked with the scooter companies to for them to pay their proportional share of that. Mm-hmm. Every operator who was in the city at the time has paid, with the exception of one. Lime has not paid us, but everyone else has.
Are you all sending Lime a nice letter saying?
Just emailed them last week with the news of them merging with Uber, assuming they now have some money to pay their bills. So yeah, we're chasing that one down.
The voice you hear is Josh Rowan, Atlanta Department of Transportation Commissioner, and we're talking about new regulations regarding e-scooters. Something else that I noticed too, Commissioner, was that I guess beginning June 1st of this year, you all are going to require e-scooter operators to submit what you call monthly summary reports. So what's expected in those reports?
Yeah, and that's really similar to what we had been doing before. We want to see where the trips are being generated, where the areas are being served, and work with them to optimize the service as we move forward.
Is there any penalty if these reports are not submitted in a timely manner? Or
yeah, if you go back and look at the legislation, we give ourselves a lot of latitude within mm-hmm. the new permit to administratively make changes, including fines. Ultimately, as commissioner, I have the ability to suspend permits if they're not cooperating with us. So that's another change that's been made, is that our team is able to be more hands-on and address issues as they come up.
Let's talk about what's new, or if anything has changed regarding the operation of these scooters in terms of the rider. First, will that 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. riding ban, will that still remain?
That is going to remain. What we've said is that it's worked. And so unless there's some data that shows that we need to reverse it, we don't want to just arbitrarily say, okay, the nighttime ban is finished. So we're evaluating it very closely, but as of now, it's staying in place.
And what about age requirements, Commissioner? Will that be regulated by you all or the scooter operator?
So, you know, the scooter operators are responsible for the overall operation of the device. That type regulation, it would be housed in their app. We've even talked to some of them about a learning mode, that where the first few rides, it's a slower speed, so mm-hmm. you can get more comfortable. There's some early indications that show that a significant percentage of the accidents happen within the first 10 rides on a scooter. So we're working with them on the safety side of their operation.
And no riding on sidewalks, that will continue as well.
Yeah, we don't want scooters on the sidewalks. That's a no-go, and, you know, it's, in fact, in violation of city code, so mm-hmm. that's going to continue.
Did you all seek any input from the e-scooter operators you all had worked with before? Did you look to see what other cities across the nation were doing in terms of regulating the e-scooters?
We did talk to a few of the operators, but to your question, we found mm-hmm. the better help was working with other cities. With our peer cities and areas like DC, Nashville, Tampa, Charlotte, just seeing what had worked for them and some of the things that they were doing. One of the things that came out of that conversation was actually, as part of the permit, we require that an operator post a bond so that should there be issues like there were in the past, we're actually able to claim against their bond and it doesn't turn into quite a drawn out issue that we had before.
There's been a lot of conversation about, should there be a requirement to wear helmets? You know, obviously, depending on whom you ask, you'll get a different answer. But is there any regulation around wearing of a helmet?
We don't have a helmet regulation. I'm personally am a helmet person. I know that there were a couple operators in other areas who tried to have helmets included with their device. It was similar to early on with the pandemic. There were operators who had Clorox wipes mm-hmm. attached to the stem of their device, and those things just managed to get stolen. I think that's one that's very difficult to manage and to oversee. And there's some conversations around, you know, how effective is the helmet on a scooter. And so, you know, we're putting the burden on them as far as the safe operation of their devices. If we start seeing an uptick in head injuries, we'll obviously hit the pause button and come back and reevaluate what's going on.
Well, that's a good lead into my next question. How do you evaluate if there needs to be a suspension of the operation of the e-scooters? Is it based on accidents, fatalities? You know, tragically, I believe in the city of Atlanta, we had 3 or 4 last time, and obviously some will say, well, look, one is too many.
We're going to be having essentially a monthly roundtable with these folks, looking at their performance data, and as well as any accident data that's available. So I think it's building again on those lessons that we've learned. We want to keep them off the sidewalks. We want to keep them, you know, in safe parts of the street, and not just necessarily have them scattered all over town. We're looking through some of our safer streets projects that can we encourage them to use certain corridors and stay off other corridors. And so a lot of the safety side of this, I think, actually can be driven by the where they ride, and then the changes that we as the city can make to the streets to provide safe passage for them.
And Commissioner, are you all looking at the model of the e-scooters? Now, from what I understand, there are some pretty high-tech, fancy e-scooters out there. Are you all looking at the models that these operators will have on the streets of Atlanta?
Yeah, we have. We specified certain parameters related to the scooters, although if you dig a little deeper, it looks like many of them get their devices from the same manufacturer and then are customizing them for their branding purposes. So, you know, the things like the 9-inch wheels, it's showing that slightly bigger is better. Mm-hmm. We do like the slightly heavier deck. I had mentioned before, I'm 6'7", so I feel like I'm bent over when I'm on one. I don't know that there's an option for a longer stem on those, but, you know, it's the devices continue to get better. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the ones that are in operation, most of them are coming from the same manufacturer. And so the differences are very subtle.
Let's talk about sanitation for a moment, because obviously we're in this state right now where that is of critical importance. Whenever these e-scooters are allowed to come back to the city of Atlanta after you all make your selections, can you really enforce and mandate that they try to keep these scooters, you know, sanitized?
Yes. In fact, that's where the conversation resides right now, where we're having conversations with them about, really, before we allow any operation, we want to approve a sanitation plan and see what all is involved. And so that's also where we've worked with other cities to look at how they're requiring sanitation of the devices, which essentially is going to be, how are you cleaning them and what's your frequency? And mm-hmm. so we will want to take a look at all of that before we allow operation.
And as we wrap up, I guess a question everyone wants to know. So when can we expect to see some more of these scooters out?
So we've developed an implementation plan. We've submitted it to Mayor Bottoms for her to review and comment. And I don't want to get out in front of her on that.
Sure.
But it does coincide with her phased reopening plan. So as we enter the phase two, assuming we stay in phase two, it would be a summer of this year. So it's sooner rather than later.
And finally, Commissioner, you know, depending on whom you ask, e-scooters are a key component in Atlanta's overall transit landscape. They are considered part of the micro mobility movement. My question for you, by your estimation, does this new legislation offer the best measures to ensure, obviously, safety, but also that it's a viable mode of transportation for the Atlanta area?
I believe it does. And one of the things we talked about and we shared with city councils, we went through this process, was that we wanted to go through this with the mindset that we wanted micromobility to be successful, to be a viable transportation solution. And what were the things that we could do to really support this? And as I mentioned earlier, one of the big things is just giving the department some flexibility to make changes as we go forward. And so that's we've put a heavy weighting on the company's ability to respond to the changing environment. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be critical because we're going to do better the first time out of the gate when we come back. But there's still going to be areas where we can improve. And we're just it's going to be this continuous improvement process to ultimately, you know, stand them up where they it's a successful model in the city. But we do feel good. We're going to start with far fewer devices, fewer operators, and kind of ease our way back into it.
And that also depends on the e-scooter operators, that they are adhering to the guidelines and regulations that you all have set forth. So it depends on them too, correct?
Yeah, the burden's on them. We think that we can create an environment for them to do very well as long as they play by the rules that we've set forward.
Have you ever looked into maybe the city should have their own e-scooters? And that would be additional revenue.
We've talked about it. We've done no more than talk about it. It's just been a conversation. So we're not ready to pull the trigger on that yet. But we do have those really with anything. We have the conversation that could we do this more effectively ourselves? Mm-hmm. Right now, we're not prepared to go down that path with the scooters.
All right. Josh Rowan is the commissioner for Atlanta's Department of Transportation. Commissioner Rowan, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thank you for having me. I look forward to when I can sit back in the studio with you and give you a hard time about college football.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org. Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. It's one of Atlanta's annual signature events. It generates approximately $60 million in revenue for the city and attracts more than 30,000 attendees from around the world twice a year. It's a family-owned business with roots right here in Atlanta that date back to 1947. This year would have been the 74th annual Browner Brothers International Beauty Show taking place in August. But like a lot of annual events and happenings, this year it won't be taking place, at least in its traditional physical sense. Now, we'll get to that in a moment. It's more than just about vendors selling hair and beauty-related products. Annual attendees call it an ongoing movement in Black and Atlanta history. And joining me now is James Browner, Senior Vice President of Show Operations. James, thanks for taking the time. Good to have you back on the program.
Glad to be back with you, Rose. Always a pleasure.
Let's begin here because I mentioned that $60 million economic impact on the city that's generated by these two annual events, but it also means an economic loss for vendors and employees. How difficult was it for y'all to have to make this decision that you weren't going to have it this year?
It was very difficult. As you know, we have a 74-year legacy in history. We haven't missed a year. Mm-hmm. And this is our first time in all those 74 years not having a physical event. So it won't be a total loss of revenue for the vendors because we will have a virtual show. Mm-hmm. So that was the safest way that we saw to do it. We looked at the data. We didn't want to make an emotional decision. And we didn't want to just make a financial decision because that's short term. So if your stylists and the barbers and the students, if they come into an environment that's unsafe, mm-hmm. and contract this disease, then it's going to affect them long term. So we've lost some of our legacy stylists, like Charles Gregory, mm-hmm. you know, the Halle Berry's hair, and just he's been with us for over 30 years. Is just one of our celebrity hairstylist. He judges our competitions, and we lost him due to this COVID-19. So mm-hmm. we've had barbers that, you know, we're still trying to see about clients before the lockdown, that people came in with symptoms and gave it to them, that has lost their lives. So we didn't want to increase that because in order to keep 6 feet, that's hard to do in a place where you got 30,000 people. So the space of the Congress Center where it's held is just not enough space to allow 6 feet of separation. Mm-hmm. So there's logistically not a safe way to do it at this time. And they've been trying to figure it out. The mayor has been, her office has been working with us trying to figure it out. There have been a lot of large events canceled because it's just difficult logistically. Same mm-hmm. thing with the school system. You know, you got a class with 30 kids. It's hard. You know, they're trying to figure out how to do that, keeping them 6 feet apart. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of what went into the decision. We listened to the experts, and you know, the CDC is right here in Atlanta, and they're not recommending large gatherings. Mm-hmm. Almost any time this year, the president's task force on this, who's looked at all the data worldwide, they're not recommending it. So we didn't want to just go by, you know, we're experts in the hair industry, but mm-hmm. not as far as disease. So we listen to those that have studied disease for 30 years and those who are studying it day in and day out, and we're following their advice.
For those registered attendees, exhibitors, and vendors, have you all had to return any fees or costs to them that might have paid up front? How did y'all work through that?
So the attendees that had registered, we issued them a full refund. So the reason we did that, a lot of conventions, they basically were giving them credit to go to the next year's event whenever they have it. But we understand a lot of people right now, especially in the beauty industry, they're hurt for finances. So we didn't want them to have trusted us with the deposit on registration and then have to wait another year before they could actually use what they paid for. Mm-hmm. So even though we're having a virtual event, we're letting them make that decision whether they want to use that money for that. But right now we put that back into their account to use for critical needs right now. Mm-hmm. So exhibitors in a similar fashion, they will have the option whether they would want to carry over their exhibition money to the virtual event. It'll and that event will probably be less cost for them, mm-hmm. but they will be able to cover over a portion of it for that, and or get a refund. We have refunded vendors already as well, so we'll leave that up to them. Mm-hmm. But my guess is the majority of them will go into the virtual event.
And we're going to get to that virtual event in just a moment. I want to shift and talk about the business for a second, James. How much does these two annual events generate for Browner Brothers each year?
It brings about $60 million to the city, and that's including from the vendors, ticket sales, restaurants, hotels, all of the local shopping that they do, which is about $30 million per show. So it is a revenue generator for Browner Brothers. So the virtual event, since it's our first time doing it, we don't know how much of that will be replaced, but we're going to do our best, and we just have to wait and see. The other part of Browner Brothers are the actual products. So
yeah, I want to get to that in a moment.
Yeah, so at least stores are opening back up, so that's helping out there.
If you're just tuning in, I'm joined by James Browner, Senior Vice President of Show Operations for Browner Brothers. You mentioned product. You all also produce hair and beauty products. Has that production slowed or stopped due to the pandemic?
So the pandemic has affected us because beauty and barber stores, they closed, you know, over the last month, and many of states are just now starting to open up. So that first month, it probably hit us about 50% down on sales. We are also in the Walmarts and grocery stores and drug stores. So those were able to stay open, and that's how we were able to keep the other 50%. But and of course, we have professional lines that sell in barber shops and beauty salons, but those were closed. So that's what took us down, but they're opening back up now. We did make a shift. So even though the hair products went down about 50%, we were able to make up some of that portion because we make products like Pump It Up, and that has alcohol in it. So we took the alcohol that we used to make Pump It Up, and we began making hand sanitizer because you couldn't get it in the stores. And it kept our employees working. So our manufacturing was able to institute the safety rules with 6 feet apart and mask and temperature checking and gloves. And we were able to continue making hand sanitizer. So that shifted things to help us. And that's called Germless, is our hand sanitizer.
The Bronner brothers not gotten the hand sanitizer business.
That's right. And it's important because
absolutely,
the beauty salons, when they were opening, they were saying, we can't get hand sanitizer. We need to sanitize often now. So it's able to provide safety there for those shops.
Now, James, did you all have to, were there any layoffs or furloughs for your company?
No, so we did not have to do any layoffs or furloughs because of the hand sanitizer. So that helped us. So, and because we were not doing a physical show, so at the time it kind of stopped all show activity. So my show staff actually had to come and help out in manufacturing to get orders out. So they actually needed some help there. And I actually got out there with them. So I got out there. I had six of my kids out there working in manufacturing. So we just rolled up our sleeves and got the job done to ship out, because the demand was so great, because they couldn't find it. So we had to ship out orders all over the country.
And as you mentioned earlier, there's this exclusive virtual experience. What does that include?
Well, we're going to try to mimic the physical show as close as possible. So it'll be a 3D looking type of experience where you will come into this building like the Congress Center, and you'll go through registration, and you'll be seeing virtual people and all of that. And it'll have a virtual exhibit hall. So you'll have these 3D renditions of booths, so much like if you've seen the game The Sims, so it looks something like that. And you'll be able to walk up and talk to, they'll have live booth reps from the company that'll be from their home or their office, and you'll be able to interact with them video or audio or text. And you'll be able to, they will have their own show deals and a store there, so you'll be able to make purchases the same way as you would at a physical show. And then we'll have classes the same way, where they'll be video-based. You'll be able to interact with the instructor. And we'll have hair competitions in the same manner. So they'll be able to win prizes and show their skills. And then we'll also have entertainment like our hair battle. So we will still mimic the physical show as close as possible. I haven't heard of any other beauty shows doing this yet. So we are kind of innovating with this. The good thing about it, I didn't know that some of my past training would come in handy for such a time as this. So the good thing, actually, I went to school for computer engineering, so I never knew I would have to use it now. So I'm actually having to find the technology and build it out and construct it myself. But the good thing is I've been prepared for this, so that's a good thing. I went to Georgia Tech
here
to study for a time such as this.
Now, James, you know I have these beautiful locks, so I should be able to find a virtual hairstylist to tell me how to keep my beautiful locks moisturized and tight, right?
That's right. And even the social aspect of the show. So we will have it's going to be a virtual lounge where you'll be there, because the show is not just a business thing. People look at it, stylists look at it like a family reunion for the industry, because they're coming from New York and California and other countries. It's sometimes the only time they get to see each other during the year. So we want to have those virtual areas where they can congregate and talk and chat. So even we're reproducing as much as possible online.
Now, I also want to shift for a moment, because as you mentioned, for a lot of hair salons and barbershops and that use your products or any products, and those that had to shut down for some time, you all understanding that, and you all are also helping fund a fund for stylists and for folks to apply to get some assistance, correct?
Correct. So we've done doing several things, because we recognize, just like our sales were down 50%, most of their sales were down 100%. When your shop is closed, you're not making any money. And we've been hearing this all over the country. So the first thing that we did is we set up And we know the government, you know, they were giving away $4 trillion, and we wanted this industry to get their fair portion. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that the need we saw, a lot of them, they didn't understand how to fill out all of the paperwork for the PPP and all of the Small Business Association loans and just all of the things that they had access to. We found that they didn't know about it, even unemployment. Normally, you have to be working somewhere to get a regular paycheck to get unemployment. But with the CARES Act, they allowed independent contractors, as many of our barbers and beauticians are, to participate. So we put all of that information in a simple to understand form, including videos, walking them through how to fill out the forms. So we put that information together for them, first of all, so they could get as much government money as possible. Now, over the last few weeks, we were hearing that our industry wasn't getting their fair share of the money. So even though they fill out the applications and even the unemployment, they just weren't getting their money like the rest of the country. So we called up a lot of our other sponsors and vendors that normally participate with us during the show. And we started the Brunner Brothers Beauty and Barber Relief Fund. So we realized that, you know, if it's up to us, we've got to pull together and make a difference. So we've started this fund where they can apply and get up to from $500 to $1,000. So it won't cover all of their bills, but it will help them some. So we put that at BrunnerBrothers.com, and also we have a separate website that they can go to is BlackBeautyRelief.com, and they can apply right there and get awarded.
And we'll have links to both of those websites on our website. As we wrap up, you're quoted as saying, if my father, Nathaniel Bronner Sr., was here, he would challenge us to find a way to maximize this moment, so the show must go on, close quote. In terms of the future for Bronner Brothers and your father's philosophy, will the business have to change at all due to this pandemic, change any of its practices, its approaches? What's your takeaway from all this as you see for the future of Bronner Brothers?
I believe all businesses will have to change because of COVID-19. So it's one of the things that resilience of entrepreneurship is something that you have to have, and not even with COVID. You know, business just has ups and downs and challenges and obstacles. My father, years ago when he was running the show, he had a sibling to die. He had to go out to the funeral. And while he was there, another sibling died. He had to leave that funeral and go to another sibling's funeral. And coming right out of two funerals of siblings, he had to still produce the show. He said the show must go on. So he understood that the people had needs. And even though he had a lot of personal things going on, they needed that show. So there are always going to be obstacles in any business. So part of entrepreneurship is that resilience, is that flexibility to be able to see and analyze what you have to offer and transform it. So just like we did from hair products into the hand sanitizer. So we're also saw a need in the beauty community as they open up these shops. They're not able to find the PPE materials to provide their safety. So we're sourcing those now for them to be able to put it in an affordable package for them. So that's another thing that we're working on. So we don't know what all the future will hold, but we do know we'll have to be flexible. We'll have to look at the needs and find the best solutions to help stylists and barbers.
Your father's philosophy still runs deep for the business. James Bronner, Senior Vice President of Show Operations for Bronner Brothers. The annual Bronner Brothers International Hair Show, a little different this year. It's all virtual. James, thanks for taking the time. I always enjoy speaking with you.
Thank you. I always enjoy being on.
Closer Look continues here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Yes, we know the coronavirus has changed so many aspects of our daily lives. Maybe you all are sick of me talking about it, but you know what? This is the work that we do because it's important. So it's changed many aspects of our daily lives, including the way we work. Now think about this. how many startups were expected to launch during this time and have now been delayed? Also, is it a good time to even start a business? In my conversation with Atlanta-based entrepreneur and business leader Jewel Burke Solomon, she talked about how the COVID-19 pandemic could change Atlanta's tech landscape. And Jewel Burke Solomon was most recently named head of Google for startups for the United States. And while some things have changed, many of Jewel Burke Solomon's observations about this pandemic's effect on Atlanta's tech scene hold true. Let's revisit that conversation. Jewel Burke Solomon, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate this.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You know, we're so used to the tech field and startups being able to enhance our daily lives, every aspect of our life. But this is different because now we have a pandemic that's affecting everything that we do. What do you make of all this, just through your personal lens?
So personally, obviously, this has been something unlike anything that we've seen before and that I've seen before in my lifetime. And for me, I've been primarily concerned about making sure that my family is okay and making sure that the teams that I work with are okay, personally, and just in terms of their mental health and their physical well-being as well. So that's been top priority for me. But as it relates to working from home, fortunately, this is something that I'm pretty used to. I've done it in the past before, and so it hasn't been too big of an adjustment. And it's something that I think being in the tech industry and having all the tools at my disposal, it's made it a lot easier. But I know there are a lot of people who are still trying to figure out how do you successfully work from home and how do you use the technology that's available to do that.
And something that we've heard a lot regarding this pandemic is, look, what this pandemic is also exposing, as if some people didn't know, inequities that lie within the haves, the have-nots, the connected, and those who are not connected, particularly in certain communities, even in the rural communities. What's your take on all that? Because one could say, well, did we really need a pandemic to expose all of this?
Well, I would say we absolutely did not need a pandemic to expose all of this, but I'm somewhat happy that people are now seeing the inequities that we already knew existed. And you think about the fact that we are asking students to do digital classrooms, but many of them don't have access to the computers to do that or to the networks, the Wi-Fi to do that. And so I think there are some companies that have stepped up and helped to make sure that students have access to the tools that they need and the hardware that they need. But it's real. It's true that there's so many inequities that exist. That the digital divide is real. And there's a lot more work to be done to ensure that folks can work from home if we're in this state for a while and students can continue to learn, even if they have to be at home.
So you think there will be some lessons learned that can be utilized even in the tech industry moving forward?
Absolutely. And I think access to reliable internet and the devices that we need to stay connected is something that I'm hoping companies really see that this is something that everyone should have access to and not just the folks who can afford to pay for it.
Let's shift to what you are heavily involved in. You know what it's like to be that tech startup, that entrepreneur taking an idea, a concept to design, to execution. So you know what that's like. If you are someone who right now is in the midst of that, how do you encourage them to weather this storm?
So I think the first thing is just deciding that you are going to weather the storm. So it's a mental exercise to say, this is going to be a hard time, but I'm going to get through it. And I think having that conversation with yourself as a leader, a founder, is the first thing that you have to do. And then from there, it's really taking inventory of, you know, what are my current costs? What does my team look like? How can I trim the fat and really bring things down so that I can keep enough cash in the bank to be able to continue my business? So I'm talking to a lot of founders about, you know, looking at their expenses and deciding which things can they freeze for the next few months or the next several months. We don't know exactly how long this is going to last. I'm really instructing people to think about this as a longer term ordeal and not something that's just going to be around for the next month or two. So those are some things that I think are super important as you think about how do you weather this storm.
If you are a venture capitalist, if you are an angel investor, But because we are in this pandemic, Jewel, do you have concerns that there might be a decrease in funding from venture capitalists?
Well, I am an angel investor, and I'm also a fund manager for a new fund called Collab Capital. So I'm looking very closely, of course, on, you know, investing and what makes sense right now in this time. And what I'm seeing is that, you know, this is actually a really great time to be investing in startups, and particularly the ones that are coming up with innovative ways to address the problems that are popping up right now that we didn't even think about before. So from an investment perspective, and for those who are investors or are looking to become investors, this is actually a great time to be looking at startups and trying to see where you can plug in and join companies that are addressing the problems that we're facing right now.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Jewel Burke Solomon. She's an Atlanta tech entrepreneur and also newly named head of Google for Startups for the U.S. We're talking about COVID-19's effect on Atlanta's tech industry as the nation as well. Let's shift to that, because Atlanta's tech landscape, we did a whole week dedicated to Atlanta's tech scene. And we heard, depending on whom you asked, everyone said, yeah, Atlanta has become this technopolis, in a sense. First of all, do you agree with that?
I do. I am very excited about all the things that are happening in the tech scene in Atlanta. I think that there's all the pieces to the puzzle, if you will. I think we have some of the best talent in the country as far as folks that are building great companies and the people that can actually join them in building the companies, so the technologists. I think we have cooperation from some of our large corporations to actually be customers to the startups. And one of the things that I think we need to continue to improve on is that investment landscape. But I'm also seeing there are new funds that are popping up and folks that are getting more excited about investing in the innovators. So I do think that we have all the pieces. I think there is still a lot of work to be done. I listened to some of the episodes from that week, and I know that, you know, there are critiques and rightfully so around some of the inequities that exist even in the tech landscape in Atlanta. But I know a lot of other people are really focused on ensuring that everyone can participate and really be a part of the success that is to come from Atlanta's tech ecosystem.
Unfortunately, there are obviously the layoffs, the rising number of unemployment benefit claims. And when we talk about the tech world, people may think, oh, maybe there's not that many layoffs. But just at the time of this interview, I know Yelp had massive layoffs. But you think of that particular model because they rely on consumers interacting with them based on being out spending their money. Well, that has come to a halt. Will it be easy, you think, for the tech industry to bounce back with their workforce development because of some of the layoffs as opposed to other sectors?
I don't know about easy. I think that in some cases, depending on kind of what tech obviously is a huge industry, so it's hard to generalize, but depending on what specifically companies are focused on, it may be easier or harder based on kind of where their targets are. But I do see that there's a lot of opportunity for people to enter the tech sector and really, you know, improve their skills around coding and product development right now, because I do think there will be a lot more opportunities in technology as we kind of continue to be in this COVID season and as we exit it. I think, as you mentioned before, telework is going to be even bigger than it is now, I think, after this season. And so getting to a point where you have the ability to work from home, which a lot of folks that are in development can do, I think that's a great thing to be doing in this time.
What was the feedback you heard from them? I imagine they talked about some concerns and challenges right now. What'd you hear?
So I think everyone that we work with is really just concerned about how do they make adjustments and know that they can continue on with their business. So depending on what industry they're in, I'm seeing a wide range of folks being affected. So, you know, but in some cases, it's actually a positive effect. So we work with a lot of ed tech startups, and they're actually seeing a boom in their business because parents are at home and they're looking for ways to entertain and educate their children. And so we have a few companies that are actually seeing this as a great time for their business. So that's been an interesting conversation and challenge to help them figure out how do they actually scale operations in this time. And then you have other businesses that are having to scale back, and they're having to make some difficult decisions about cutting employees or, you know, trying to figure out how do they continue to generate revenue in this time, get creative and adjust and make changes in their business models. So all of those things are what we're spending a lot of time working with founders to help them navigate. And the hope is that they can come up with plans that allow them to continue operations through the end of this time.
Jewel, you are considered a leader in this tech space. I want to end with you giving your own personal message to other leaders. When I talk to so many CEOs and directors, they always talk about the importance of leading during a crisis. So through your lens, what do you say to those who are in those positions and what they must do now for their teams or for their organizations?
My message is just to put your people first. I think folks are going to really remember how they were treated in this time. And the interesting thing about this particular crisis that we're in is that it's a very human crisis, and we never know when we're going to be personally impacted or when our family members are going to be impacted. And it's our health that we're talking about. And so that is the key message that I'm thinking about and that I would impart to others, is that at the end of the day, of course, we want businesses to continue to thrive and be successful, but we also want people to live and have their health. And so that's what I'm doing, is checking in with folks, making sure that they're healthy, they're safe, and that they are in good spirits, because I think this is a unique challenge in that, you know, we're going to have to mourn differently. You know, we're going to have people loss around us and not going to be able to funeralize folks in the same ways. And those are some of the things that are the kind of implications of all of this that are really hard to grapple with. But I think if we continue to put that first in our minds, as far as how we interact with people, how we check in on them, and how we even interact with our customers as business owners, I think that will make all the difference.
Jewel Burke Solomon, newly named head of Google for Startups for the U.S. and also an Atlanta-based tech entrepreneur. Thank you so much for taking the time. Good information, good advice. Thank you, Jewel.
Thank you.
That was my conversation back in April with Jewel Burke Solomon, an Atlanta tech entrepreneur and newly named head of Google for Startups for the U.S. Now, since that conversation aired, I've also spoken to numerous business leaders, developers, and entrepreneurs. So we're going to keep the conversation going about how the pandemic has affected the way we all work. I want to hear from you, especially the gig workers or independent contractors. If you'd like to share your story, send me an email, rose@wabe.org. That's rose@wabe.org. If you're a gig worker or independent contractor, how are you doing in all of this? Let me know. That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.